You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I actually think it will get even better. And this is, make no mistake, this is a repeal and a replace of Obamacare. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake.
The latest attempt to get Trump care to happen. Is America ready for the health insurance equivalent of Trump stakes? My guests, Daniel Giacopelli and Matt Alagaya, will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including...
One of the things that we're going to have to do over the next decade is to ultimately arrive at some rules of what is a new game, and that is the way in which traditional propaganda and traditional covert influence efforts are being turbocharged by the internet.
What the previous president knew and when about Russian election hacking and why he didn't do more about it. The startling news that at least one Trump doesn't seem to want to join the family firm, and something Londoners will be hearing more of if the mayor gets his way. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's business editor, Matt Alagaya, and Monocle 24 producer, Daniel Giacopelli. Welcome both. We will start in the US, where President Donald Trump's latest attempts to replace the health care scheme known as Obamacare with something he assures Americans will be terrific are refusing to go entirely according to plan. The new proposal, drafted in secret by a cohort of Republican senators, is receiving mixed reviews, especially among not-rich people who enjoy being insured. Of more immediate political importance is that a small but crucial number of Republican senators aren't all that keen on it either. Daniel, have we yet understood what Trump's actual objection to Obamacare is? Is it just that it's called Obamacare?
If
the last thing he'd done before leaving office was just go, I'm just going to rename it Trump Care, it'd be fine, wouldn't it?
I think that a big part of it is the name and the fact that Obama came up with it. I mean, if you do recall, when Trump was meeting with Malcolm Turnbull, the prime minister of your fine country.
I remember it well.
Do you remember the comment? So he was talking about how bad Obamacare was, and then he turned to Malcolm Turnbull and he said, it's going to be fantastic out there. I shouldn't say this to the great gentleman and my friend from Australia, because you have better health care than we do. And of course, the great irony.
We do have better health care than you do.
And it's universal health care.
It is.
Which is the great irony. I mean, what Trump did is he said many, many, many times, if you go far back and look at interviews, he said everybody will be covered. So he was for universal health care, which is, in his view, socialism. But he just saw it as universal health care.
But that's
just, which is what Obamacare is.
But it's just what he does all the time. He just says, everything's going to be fantastic. It'll be great.
That could have fallen into one of those categories where he wasn't even understanding what he was saying and he just thought he was taking care of every voter as opposed to kind of doing something that could be seen as socialism. But I think a big thing about the Obamacare thing is it's just called Obamacare.
And I think there's also, I mean, to be fair, I think, you know, Republicans for many, many years hated Obamacare and have wanted to repeal it. I mean, the fact is it does intervene in markets, which they detest, and it's risen. You know, Obamacare does have problems. It's made premiums higher as well. I mean, I'm not criticizing it necessarily, but, and one of the other things that that the Republicans have always disliked is that it brings power from a state level to a federal level. And before Obamacare, it was very much at a state level. And what this act seems to want to do is move it back to more of a state level.
Is it possible, do you think, though, Matt, that this might go off in Trump's face somewhat? Because the estimates are, the best guess from nonpartisan sources are that 23 million people who are currently insured will lose their insurance. Quite a lot of those 23 million people might well have been Trump voters.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's really important to know here is that it's also subsidies for people who buy their own. So low-income families that buy their own insurance who are subsidized at the moment, those subsidies will be cut under these proposals, and it's basically it's high income earners who will get tax cuts both on their pay and on investment income as well. It makes sense that a lot of the people who voted for Trump will be affected by this.
And of course, Medicaid, which is what Obamacare expanded, will be contracted and actually cut further, and that's what helps the lowest of low income people.
Danny, to reduce this question to fundamentals, and it is you'll have lived outside America long enough to know that it is one of the things that baffles outsiders about America. Why is it not just taken as a given, the way it is in every other developed country on Earth, that the state provides a healthcare system?
Well, it all comes down to that kind of, like, that Protestant work ethic of, you know, you make your own way in the world and, you know...
But the Protestant work ethic exists in Protestant European countries, for example.
Fair enough. But I forgot what senator it was, and I don't want to name somebody who actually it wasn't, but there was an intern of a senator who got in a lot of hot water in the past few days for tweeting pretty bad things. And one of the things he tweeted was like, you know, healthcare isn't a right that should be tied... You know, it's not a universal right, a human right, healthcare. And if you're too poor or lazy to work your way and get a job where that pays for healthcare, then you should, like, essentially die on the streets. And so it's this very Darwinian kind of thing where, you know, if you don't earn it, you don't deserve it. And that is a kind of an American thing.
And Matt, what's your sense of the extent to which that line of thinking is underpinning these proposed reforms? I guess what I'm asking is from the point of view of the people who have drafted these reforms, do they see what they're doing as essentially practical, i.e. making the policy better, or is this an ideological crusade and the consequences of that are a lesser priority?
I mean, I feel like this is much more ideological than practical, because I think, as Danny said, Trump in the past has said things that are kind of, he likes the idea of universal healthcare potentially, but ideologically he can't stand anything that was Obama legislation and has Obama's name in the title. So that feels very, very ideological. I mean, I'm not sure if they do know that I'm not sure they do know what they're going to be doing to people who are at the moment using Medicaid or have subsidized healthcare. But it feels pretty scary, to be honest, what they're doing.
But we should say also, I mean, Matt, you touched upon it a bit before, Obamacare is also, in some parts, deeply unpopular, and it is a flawed, you know, it's a flawed program. It's not a perfect thing. I mean,
right.
the big thing that people hate about it, a lot of people do, is the individual mandate in which, you know, they force you to have coverage, and if you don't have coverage, you pay a fine. A lot of people, that doesn't, you know, they don't like that. So this doesn't actually, this new plan doesn't add anything good. It only makes things worse. But Obamacare wasn't perfect either.
From a point of view of political, practical reality, Danny, the GOP, I believe I'm right in saying, have 52 senators. They need 50 plus the vice president's tiebreaker to get this through. There's already four GOP senators, Cruz, Johnson, Lee and Paul, saying they won't vote for it as it is. It's not clear to me whether that might be because they think it doesn't go heavy enough on the every man for himself and devil take the hindmost.
Well, that's the irony. That's the irony. A lot of people opposed it, the original version, whenever it was, a couple months ago, because it didn't go far enough.
Oh, for heaven's sake. So is this actually going to happen?
I don't know. I don't want to make any predictions because I've been wrong in the past 2 years of everything that's happened in the world. But
particularly in America.
Yeah, particularly in America.
Well, as
know.
Have we all.
Yeah. But I'll say no. Why not?
Well, let's move along, if not necessarily that far. We will stay in the United States, despite our ironclad record of being absolutely wrong about it. Earlier this week, interestingly, in much the same way that if one throws a handful of gravel at a barn door, some of it will hit the target, President Donald Trump did tweet something startlingly close to a good point. If Russia was working so hard on the 2016 election, he typed with his tiny orange thumbs, it all took place during the Obama administration. Why didn't they stop them? Now, one of the reasons that we're looking at this is a long and absolutely riveting piece, which has just gone up in the Washington Post, which I recommend to all our listeners. It seems a very well-sourced and well-researched piece suggesting the extent of Obama's knowledge and his various options for retaliating. Matt, should he have done more, and could he practically have done more?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, this Washington Post piece says that they've interviewed around 3 dozen people in the Obama administration. And it's funny, some of them said, no, I think we did the right thing. We didn't know enough at the time. But a lot of people that they've interviewed, and a lot of them have remained anonymous, they've said it was the worst moment of the administration, and that they failed to act when they really should have. I mean, my feeling is that they could have done a lot of things. They could have retaliated. I mean, you can have cyber weapons was something that they thought about doing. They considered leaving cyber weapons in Russian infrastructure, which then you can kind of detonate.
There's
as
some
it were,
there's some suggestion
on.
That they may be there,
may be there, and
theoretically, yes, at the command of Donald Trump, which casts further potentially interesting light on his relationship with Russia. That line of Matt's there, Danny, Obama not acting when he really should have, that is kind of the epitaph of his presidency in a couple of key moments. Syria, most obviously. But is this another one of those, and is this potentially, well, at least as serious?
Yeah, I mean, you're referring to the whole leading from behind tagline that's been put on him, it all depends on how you see that title. But I think, so this is what happened. So, I mean, it was in early August, the Obama administration was told by the CIA, Russia's up to no good with our election. It was a super classified kind of document that Obama got. And this Washington Post piece goes into how they dealt with it. And as Matt pointed out, you know, they kind of juggled a few different options, and they decided on this modest package of kind of a response.
Largely implemented after the election.
Indeed. The expulsion of 35 diplomats, Russian diplomats, very kind of narrow sanctions. But it raises the question of what could you have done? I mean, yes, some administration officials might be kind of, you know, regretful of how they handled it. But really, what could they have done?
Because I guess, yeah, I mean, it's one of those situations in which all the options look awful for all sorts of reasons.
Indeed.
If the Republican candidate had been anybody else, would Russia have necessarily bothered? But Matt, you can imagine that with Donald Trump already attempting to cast doubt on the legitimacy of the election and suggest that it was being rigged against him. If Barack Obama had gone public and said, look, we think Russia's trying to fiddle this election for Donald Trump, that would just have fed into his conspiracy narrative, wouldn't it?
Totally. And yeah, as you say, Trump was saying the entire time that the election was already rigged and it was already rigged against him. It was already a very nasty, angry and cynical campaign that he was running. So if Obama comes out and says, you know, the Russians are getting involved and meddling and trying to make Hillary Clinton look bad, the Russians obviously come out and flatly deny that. And then it's effectively Obama's word again.
Russia denies everything.
Look at what happens now. We know that Russia did this. Like, categorically, Russia interfered in the democratic process of the United States presidential election. And still, Trump supporters don't give a crap. I mean, they either don't believe it or they don't care. So if Obama said it, you know, who would have believed Obama on the Republican side? You know, I mean, probably not a lot of people. They probably would have immediately thought it was this partisan thing. I mean, you have guys like Comey, you know, this like kind of Boy Scout, straight-laced kind of guy saying, this is what happened. And still, you go on Breitbart and it's all just kind of like, you know, this is all overblown. Russia didn't really do it, you know. Even going so far as waving Russian flags at some Trump rallies. I mean, maybe inadvertently, but there's some crazy things we've seen in the past couple months.
Well, Donald Trump did quite publicly invite Russia to hand over or hack Hillary Clinton's emails even further and hand over anything they found.
Obama could have done more. I mean, let's put it that way. But what could he have done? I don't know. I mean, I'm not in the White House. But, you know, you have guys like the former ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, who said, you know, Russia, the Kremlin should have paid a higher price for that attack. They violated our sovereignty. Which begs the question, what would you have done?
I suppose, I mean, one of the things is you could have retaliated. They have sensitive information about Putin that they could have released. They could have had way tougher sanctions put on Russia. But at the same time, you escalate the situation, and who knows what Putin then does if you've retaliated. It could get much nastier, much quicker. But the other thing that I think motivated the Obama administration, which we haven't touched on yet, is I think they possibly, just like all of us, underestimated Trump's popularity, underestimated the likelihood that he was going to win. And so they thought, either we can discredit Hillary Clinton once she's won, then people will slightly doubt the credibility of the campaign. And maybe they just felt, we don't need to complicate things. You know, she's going to win. Trump is a lunatic. And I think, like everyone, they completely underestimated
it. I think it's a really good point. No, that's probably one of the primary reasons they didn't act. They thought Clinton was a shoo-in, and why rock the boat? And also remember, this didn't happen in a vacuum. They were also kind of dealing with Russia on, you know, the future of Syria, you know, the trying to get Eastern Ukraine in check, you know, peace. So, you know, you have all these foreign policy things that you have going on at the same time. And it's not like you could just respond to this and blow up all those other things.
That's very true. We are looking at this from the point of view of people who know now that Trump did win in November and is now actually the president of the United States. It's very easy to see how, yeah, this time last year, they might just have been thinking, look, if Russia wants to hack the election to help Donald Trump knock themselves out, there's no way he's going to win. Do you think that's the simplest explanation that fits the facts?
Makes sense to me.
Well, if Hillary Clinton was the president now, would this be a 4,000-word story in the Washington Post that Russia tried to get Donald Trump the presidency? I doubt it. I think what makes it, it's hindsight that's making this such a big story.
Yeah, I mean, if Clinton won and this came out, there would be investigations, for the next couple of years, but it wouldn't be like this.
Just before we move on, we should talk about, I mean, it comes and it goes, but it never quite goes away, Trump and Russia. Matt, is there any way he's ever going to be able to extricate himself from this, or is this just going to follow him around? There is now stories saying that he's now trying to cast doubts upon the neutrality of Robert Mueller, who is, of course, investigating the relationship between the Trump campaign and Russia. Trump has described Mr. Mueller's friendship with James Comey, who was, of course, his successor as director of the FBI, as bothersome. And Trump did also call Mr. Mueller an honorable man, which is that's the sort of thing a football club chairman says about the coach about 24 hours before he sacks him, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Without quite realizing that you're quoting Shakespeare at the same time.
If Trump quoted Shakespeare, that's almost certainly a coincidence.
Exactly. To be honest, I think you're right. I think this will, he will never extricate himself from this. I think this will dog his presidency for as long as it lasts. And it's his fault. I mean, he hasn't. If you were going to run his PR, you would tell him to not get involved so frequently on Twitter, to be very kind of adult and stand up to these things and say, look, we want openness, we want transparency. At every turn, he has seemed to try and obfuscate the process.
What do you think, Danny? Is this going to be the thing that gets him before his time?
Oh, well, I mean,
because we still don't really have an actual smoking gun, really.
Well, let's wait. I mean, Robert Mueller has assembled an ace crack team of like dozens of the top lawyers in the country to investigate a lot of different paths of malfeasance. I mean, we don't know anything yet. I think it'll get really good. But that being said, even if Mueller, not you, the other Mueller.
Yes, no relation, just so we're clear on that.
Even if he does come up with 50 smoking guns, you still have to get the majority of Congress on board. And Republicans have to come to a point where they say, we'd rather get rid of this guy and face the wrath of him on Twitter, or keep the status quo and have a possible criminal as president.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Daniel Jacopelli and Matt Allegaier. Coming up next, discovered a member of the Trump entourage who doesn't want to be promoted a mile out of their depth on the basis of their name.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into The Menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine. And he baked me a potato, and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monocle's program on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers, and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippie, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. Vegetables, sorry, I said to say carrots, but I love carrots, so I meant vegetables in general.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniel Jacopelli and Matt Allegaier. Now, Donald Trump's presidency to date has, of course, consisted substantially of Trump actually doing the kind of things that used to be the subject of jokes about the kind of thing Trump would do if he actually became president. That being the case, the idea that his first ex-wife, Ivana Trump, could be nominated as the U.S. ambassador to her native Czech Republic now just seems like the sort of thing that happens. And indeed, it turns out, might well have, but but for Ms. Trump's own reluctance. Danny, she apparently thought the job would be too demanding. I mean, how hard could it be being U.S. ambassador to the Czech Republic? Be quite a good gig.
Well, so apparently back in November, she expressed an interest in the role. She said, "This is where I'm from and my language, and everybody knows me."
Fair enough.
So the baseline requirements are there. You know, an ambassador's role is to schmooze. An ambassador's role is to kind of represent U.S. foreign policy. But, you know, I mean, recently it's become kind of much more schmoozing than foreign policy. I mean, Obama is actually kind of a culprit in this kind of thing where you appoint people close to you, you appoint kind of people who donate to your political campaigns. But it's still a tough job. I mean, it's not like you're kicking back and, you know, going to the spa.
I don't know. This strikes me as one of the easier ones. If you're going to be the U.S. ambassador somewhere, I'm sure it's a really nice house in a lovely part of Prague.
Oh, yeah.
You'd get invited to some good parties.
Indeed. Indeed, you would. Yeah, and it's not like you're the ambassador to Iraq or Afghanistan where you actually have to do some real foreign policy on the ground. I mean, the U.S.-Czech relation, how's that going?
Not entirely. I do think being a U.S. ambassador under the current administration might be a little bit tougher than it has been in the past, in that Donald Trump could just tweet at any moment that he's going to war with the country you're in, and you'd have to sort of go rush
presumably
to the...
Presumably, especially if he used to be married to him.
Exactly. Yeah. Rushing to the foreign minister.
Indeed. I mean, the Czech president, though, Matt, Miloš Zeman, rather, is apparently furious that she's not taking the job. Why would he have been so keen?
Well, that is so... I think that's really interesting because I think it shows that foreign leaders think that they have a very good chance of having Trump's ear if they have a Trump family member in the ambassador's house. I think if you've got one of his ex-wife in the residency, then you have his ear. And I think that's why he was so furious, because that was a great opportunity for the Czech Republic and US relations to be much, much closer.
It does tell us a lot, doesn't it, Danny, about how foreign leaders are beginning to understand that this White House is a family racket.
Indeed. I mean, you look at the Trump, the hotel in Washington, D.C. I mean, you have foreign ambassadors going there literally just to say, "I stayed at your hotel. Hi, how are you? You know, I supported your kind of..." And they've said that. They've said, "How could we possibly stay at a competitor's hotel when you have an equally good hotel? And, you know, what would that seem?" But it seems now the actual ambassador to the Czech Republic will be Steve King, the congressman from Iowa.
Not the popular
author.
Again, though, but how surprised would you be at this point? You'd just be, yeah, fine.
Yeah.
The Shining's his favorite film.
Well, exactly.
So
King's kind of an uber Republican. He's a current congressman.
I mean, you know, Toby Keith, ambassador to Afghanistan. It, like, literally wouldn't surprise me at this point.
Sarah Palin to... I guess Russia's too low-hanging fruit, but...
Again, but how surprised would you actually be? I mean, Danny, doing that thing again where I'm asking you to speak on behalf of 330 million of your diverse and variegated country folk, why do you still have such a soft spot as a people for political dynasties? The Trumps are not the first. You guys went through an entire revolution to slough off the idea of inherited power and privilege, and yet this keeps happening.
I don't know if this is actually a case of that. I think this is more nepotism than dynastic. I think this is kind of putting your family members in places.
You say tomato.
I mean, dynasty like the Kennedy dynasty, that was more like, you know where they stand. They're liberal, northeastern, you know, kind of smart Ivy League people. And so the son or daughter will be kind of similar, you know, grain. This is simply like Trump wanting to have, you know, a good kind of hold on his various ambassadors. And if his ex-wife is one of them, all the better, because he knows her.
And I guess the Kennedys all rose up together, really, didn't they? Whereas the Trumps is very much one singular line from father to son.
Well, I mean, but which raises the horrifying prospect. What if Donald Trump is the Senator Joe Kennedy of this? What if he's the founder?
Well, I mean, look at Ivanka. So a lot of people saying she has her eye on something, some political office, and she might make a run for something at some point. But I mean, if you look at... Yeah, I mean, again, I don't want to bring it back to the kind of the Obama thing, but the whole fundraiser thing, or people close to you, you know, that started real in like big depth in the past decade, when Obama and George W. Bush started handing out these things to big donors. I mean, the current ambassador, well, who just left London, Barzun, he was Obama's biggest, one of his biggest sponsors in the campaign. And it seems now, I think The Guardian did some research, it's $1.8 million is the average donation to get an ambassadorship. So that's like the cost of becoming a diplomat. And of course, the professional class of the State Department do not like this at all.
Well, let's, on that happy thought, move along finally tonight to London, where the newish mayor, Sadiq Khan, has released his first transport strategy. Its central theme appears to be one of reducing still further London's reliance on private vehicles in favour of a mix of walking, cycling and public transport. Khan wants to cut car journeys by 3 million a year and get London to a point where by 2041, he's clearly thinking a few mayors down the track, 80% of journeys will be undertaken without cars. Matt, there's no real argument I can see against this, really. Is there, in central London especially, I think people forget how close everything is. It still blows my mind on my tube journey home from Monocle in the evenings, the number of people you see getting on the tube at Bond Street and then getting off it at Oxford Circus. Literally quicker to walk.
Absolutely, yeah. You're going down further than you're going across in many ways. Yeah, I know. It's a funny transport, this scheme that he's announced. I feel like it is, as you said, fairly innocuous. I don't think many people would disagree with this. It's very safe. I think Sadiq Khan's been good, but he hasn't been hugely ambitious so far. And this feels like something that looks ambitious, but actually, I think a lot of people would say, yes, this obviously makes sense. This is where every city in the world is heading. And it kind of brings us onto, I guess, the same footing as some of the other European cities that have this long-term vision to become car-free.
I mean, I don't know about you guys. I've never owned a car in London. I cannot see the point.
I can't drive in this country.
Is it because everyone drives? Is it because
banned.
Everyone drives on the wrong side of the road, Danny? Well, is that the problem?
You joke, but yeah, I haven't gotten my license yet because of that. I mean, that is a big hurdle. But anyway, even if I did, I wouldn't drive because I take the bus every day. And I'm actually rarely in the tube. I take the bus. I don't cycle, although I should probably learn. But London's kind of a death trap for cycling.
One thing that's quite interesting, though, about this whole debate is that the car share schemes and the Ubers of this world are actually making this a lot more difficult. I think a lot of people argue that Uber certainly puts more cars back on the road than there would have been normally. It makes it cheaper and more efficient to be in a car than on public transport. And I think at the beginning, Uber used to say, oh yeah, we're taking cars off the road because it's really efficient to have people in the back of a car and the car's constantly moving. But actually now there are so many Toyota Priuses out there driven by Uber drivers, and it's people who ordinarily would be on the tube or would be on the buses. So it's an interesting thing that you've got this, you know, the municipality saying we really want cars off the road, but then you've got this San Francisco-based company which is putting more of them back on the roads.
But the future is going to be, though, isn't it, Danny, non-car ownership? Even people who want to drive themselves will share cars, hire cars, as that becomes a more and more efficient and easier thing to do.
Yeah, there's so many services out there where you could just get a car on demand. Not like Uber where you have a driver, but just pick up a car. I mean, there's that company Drive Now here in London where you literally pick up a car, drop it off wherever you want on the curb, lock it, and then somebody else can use an app to find the nearest car to them, and you open it up with an app and you just kind of get in and drive away. I mean, that's kind of collective shared ownership, and it's much more cost effective for everybody.
And London's so far behind, I mean, particularly Germany on this. I was living in Germany about 7 years ago, and they had exactly the same scheme in a couple of cities. So we're lagging slightly behind.
It's actually
behind
the same company. It's BMW.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Matt, just finally, I guess, Danny did mention the difficulties of cycling in London. It is dangerous. Far too many people are still killed and injured. Should more be done? And as a part of that, and again, I'm bracing myself for the emails I'm about to receive, should more actually be done to make cyclists behave better?
Definitely. I think you're right in both on both counts. Definitely more needs to be done to protect cyclists. We know that cycle lanes, when they're done properly, do protect cyclists, and we don't have enough of them in this city, partly because so many of the roads are so old and there's not enough space to put them in. But yeah, definitely infrastructure-wise, we do need to protect cyclists a bit more. But also, you do see cyclists skipping red lights and going way too fast and shouting at people. We've had conversations on this radio station before where we say that actually cycling in London is also an aggressive thing. Where
this is Matt Alagaya speaking to all our cyclist listeners. That's Alagiah. Although I do agree with him entirely. My only irritation with Sadiq Khan's plan is that it does not address at all the menace of umbrella users. I realize this.
Well, like big umbrellas on the
Umbrellas, full stop. They should be outlawed. They should literally be banned.
You say this in a city in which it rains quite frequently.
Yeah, well, in which case, wear a raincoat. I mean, it's not complicated. that brings us, that jarring note of common sense, to the end of today's show. Matt Alagaya and Daniel Giacopelli, thanks for joining us at Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Fiammetta Chisana. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900, it's The Menu, and there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.